You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Hey, Robert Shuler, the legal schnauzer, blog, got let out of jail yesterday. This is a long and twisted tale, and I hope that we can get him on the program and talk about it as time goes on. Governor Siegelman, Don Siegelman, the former governor of Alabama, another one of America's political prisoners, is still in jail. You can learn more about that over at free-don.org. Interesting piece in the New York Times today about reverse mortgages that I wanted to share with you. The sociopathic 1% at the heart of the Tea Party as well. What happens when we privatize government functions? Things go to hell and people, taxpayers get screwed. And what happens when an atheist walks into a bank? This is particularly fascinating. David Silverman is with us. He's the president of American Atheists. The website is atheists.org. The Twitter is at American Atheists. And David, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on again, Tom.
Great to have you with us. And by the way, you've got a convention coming up?
We do. We have our national convention coming up. It's a fun thing to say. It's the American Atheist National Convention on Easter weekend in Salt Lake City. And just let that sink in for a second. Atheist convention, Easter weekend, Salt Lake City. It's perfect. And we're really looking forward to having it. And I hope everybody comes out to see it. It's only 3 weeks away, and we have fantastic speakers. We've got a dance. We've got a costume ball. We've got an art show. We've got comedy. It's going to be fantastic. I hope everybody comes.
Wonderful. Now, I understand you were in a bank and a notary said, sorry, I'm not going to notarize your papers, which was for different atheist groups around the, you know, state groups around the country that were presumably incorporating or something. And
no, it was for us. It was for American Atheists.
Right.
And one of the things that we as a national organization have to do is we have to register our organization in every state.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And we register our organization in every state. We keep it right above, you know, that's what we have to do. And we've been
right
to this bank several times, and they notarize our stuff all the time. But this time, this person looked at our stuff, said, what do you do? We said, we're an atheist organization. We do this. We're a nonprofit organization for atheists. And she said, oh, well, for personal reasons, I'm going to refuse to do this. I'm allowed to do this. This is bank policy. I'm allowed to do this.
Right.
She said, it's not business. It's not the bank policy that we're refusing you. It's me. I'm allowed to do this because I'm a notary public. Let me see if there's someone else who can do this.
Now, legally, she could not have done that if you were black, right? If she asserted that your skin color was the reason why she wasn't doing it.
Well, legally, I don't believe she was able to do it anyways, because New Jersey has a law against discrimination for everything.
Okay, because that's where I was going with this, is you know, race and then religion.
Right. Certainly, if she said, I'm not going to sign anything for a Jewish organization, she'd be thrown out and fired immediately.
Right.
Right.
So, so here's the conundrum. Why don't you guys assert, because I'm guessing her defense would be she's not a bigot against, on religious grounds, because you're asserting no religion. Why don't you guys assert atheism as a religion?
Because it's not a religion. It's the absence of religion.
Well, that's agnosticism. We've had this conversation before,
David. What we want to do is we want to stick to the truth here. We could try and do that, but it's not true. Atheism isn't a religion. It's the absence of religion. It's a religious position. And according to the Supreme Court, we do have all the rights that religions do. So
right,
we don't have to assert ourselves as a religion. We have a religious position, and the Supreme Court has said we have all the rights of a religion. Religion can't be put above us.
Right.
So there has been a crime committed, but we're not asking for her head. We're not asking for her to be fired, although she would be fired if she said the same thing about Jews or Muslims. If she did this thing to anybody else, she'd be fired.
Or Christians.
We're not asking.
Can you imagine that? If she did it to a Christian, she'd be Bill O'Reilly's guest tonight.
Exactly. Exactly.
In fact, she may still be.
Discrimination against atheism is still okay in this country, which is why American Atheists exists, and it's why we fight.
Yeah.
Discrimination against atheists is still rampant, it's still prevalent, but it's not okay, and it deserves to be fought, and it deserves to be fought hard and at its source. So what we're doing is we're asking the bank to correct the employee and just to, you know, apologize it. That's all we're asking for. Unfortunately, the bank has refused to do that so far and has come back saying, oh, she just needed help with the form, so she went to get somebody else.
So they're asserting it didn't happen the way that you're asserting it happened.
Yeah, they're lying.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Do you want to name the bank?
Why in the world would a notary have a problem notarizing a signature? Why would she say, why would she do it after she asked us about our organization? And then the second person that she brought in, we talked to him about it. And he said, you know, we said exactly this. We said, if this had been done to a Jew or a Muslim, she'd be fired. And he said, well, she has the right to do this. And then he said, this was amazing. He said, as he was notarizing our stuff, he said, she has the right to do this. And by the way, that's why there are lots of other banks, if you don't like the way we have handle ourselves here.
Wow.
There are lots of other banks. Yeah.
Do you want to name the bank?
New Jersey. What?
Do you want to name the bank?
Yeah, it was TD Bank.
TD Bank.
TD Bank, supposedly the one that's all about diversity, is TD Bank here in New Jersey. And I'm beside myself a little bit.
Yeah.
Because here in New Jersey, it's 2014, and we're not supposed to have that kind of problem here.
Well, why not actually bring a legal action against the bank? I mean, this is the way that you establish for future bigots that is not acceptable behavior.
It's not out of the question. It's not out of the question. Admittedly, our damages here are pretty minimal. We got it signed. You know,
right.
They did bring in somebody else. We were served. It was just a matter of sitting here and saying, oh, well, this person doesn't do your kind. Let's find somebody who will lower himself or herself to do that.
Right.
And it was so backwards. It felt so 1950s.
Yeah.
And then for the bank.
Well, in a way, it's also so 2014, because the religion wars are really full tilt boogie. I mean, this is Fox News' whole thing. You know, the war on Christmas. Oh, my God. People aren't being Christian enough. The atheists
yeah,
are.
And have we noticed now that bigotry and discrimination is actually coming back in vogue because religion is defending it and pushing it? All of a sudden,
my point.
Bullying is bad unless it's for religious reasons, then it's okay.
Right.
Discrimination is bad unless it's for religious reasons, then it's okay. It's not okay. Bigotry and discrimination isn't okay.
Yeah.
It's stupid.
I agree, whether it's against the, you know, a religion like Catholicism or a religion like atheism. Is there a National Association of Agnostics?
No. Agnostics are atheists. They don't like the word, but agnostics are atheists with almost a 100% shot. Remember, atheism is simply the absence of an active belief in a God.
It's atheism.
Right.
And a
so it doesn't mean you know
is without,
in the universe.
Right?
Yeah.
A in Latin.
It doesn't mean you know everything in the universe. It doesn't. We don't stand up and say we're 100% sure there is no unicorns or there are no gods. We say that given all of the evidence, there's nothing to make us believe. If some evidence shows up, we're all going to change our minds. But until that time, we're atheists, and fiction is fiction. And
don't you think it's kind of dangerous to speak on behalf of all atheists?
Yeah, you're probably right. Let me just talk about the majority of atheists. I think
okay.
The vast majority of atheists, I would say all good skeptics.
Yeah.
All good skeptics, I can say.
Yeah.
If you show them evidence, they'll believe it, as long as it's good evidence. As long as
but
it's
I, you know, I would assert,
evidence.
I would assert, for example, these people who call themselves climate skeptics, that this is a belief system. You know, it just seems to me like it should be considered a religion.
What, climate skepticism?
Well, you know, I think that that's a bizarre religion, frankly, except for the people who are doing it because they're paid to do it.
All these things are
assertions of belief systems. This is my understanding of how the universe works.
And if your understanding has scientifically valid proof behind it, you can be skeptical and still hold that. And that's what the difference is between a skeptic and a religionist, because a skeptic needs proof to believe what he believes.
Well, yeah, maybe. I mean, there's a skeptics organization that's pretty fundamentalist, too. Anyhow, David Silverman, hang on just a second, David.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
President of American Atheists, atheist.org. They've got their convention coming up Easter Sunday in Salt Lake City. Check it out on their website. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Good talking to you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is Nate Sweet, international television superstar and producer of The Big Picture. Hey, Dave. Hey, Nate. How are you doing?
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good. So, for tonight's show, we're going to start out with Mr. Papantonio.
Yeah, we got our weekly Pap attack on the show today. Pap's going to be on talking about a new lawsuit that's alleging that Wells Fargo didn't just accidentally fabricate mortgage documents, but intentionally fabricated documents and actually had a manual on how to fabricate those documents. So some pretty startling stuff that Wells Fargo allegedly did. If it's true, it's pretty damning. It's interesting nonetheless, considering, the ongoing mortgage crisis that this country's in. There was that settlement last year, but the banks have sort of continued some of their illicit practices.
Yeah. And they're continuing to. On an ongoing basis. This is totally bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, mortgage law is confusing. People don't know what they're getting into, and it's very easy for these institutions to rip people off.
Yeah. Following this, we're going to have Dr. Michael Hudson, who's going to be talking about the IMF. The news hook for this is the IMF is offering a bunch of money to Ukraine, right?
Yeah, it's going to be $18 billion that they're offering as a package to Ukraine that's going to involve some cuts to their gas subsidies as well as some other public programs.
In other words, we will loan you money, not give you money. We will loan you money. We will make a profit on this loan. And in exchange for that, you've got to whack it to your people.
Right. And, Ukrainian gas subs, I think gas prices already expect to rise like 50% this year. Yeah. So with those subsidies, it's going to be a massive increase in energy costs for, let's face it, a country that's pretty cold. In Northern Europe, it's going to be it's a very cold country. So that's going to hit people pretty hard. Which is usually the case when these IMF reforms come in. It's supposedly for reforming for everybody to make things better for everyone, but usually the people on the lower end of the economic spectrum face most of the brunt of the punishment from them.
Yeah, I don't think Ukraine is Northern Europe. That's Scandinavia. I think that it's Eastern Central Europe, but still, that's a climate similar to Michigan.
Yeah. It's a cold area. Next to Russia.
Yeah. I think they're probably at a latitude that's roughly the same as Michigan,
right,
too.
Right. And so, Mike, we're going to talk about that with Michael Hudson, really analyze what the IMF's up to into Ukraine. But then we're going to move beyond that to talk about the general structure of the IMF as a whole. It's this institution that's mostly backed by Washington and the Western world that supposedly exists to reform countries and get them on the path to prosperity. But history has shown time and time again that it's really often a vehicle for shock doctrine type of capitalism. The IMF pushed through reforms in Russia in the 90s that decimated that country's economy in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Right.
Those are pretty unsuccessful, and a lot of people suffered from it. So we'll look at some bigger picture issues about the IMF with Michael Hudson.
Agreed. And in our fourth block, in Block D, it's the 35th anniversary of the Three Mile Island disaster.
Right. It's one of the worst nuclear contamination disasters in American history, for a lot of people.
Although the industry continues to claim that, no droids in that car.
Yeah. A lot of people, it's pretty startling event. A lot of people forget that it happened in this country, even though, the lingering effects are still there. So we'll be talking with Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear about that, and then connecting it to some of the ongoing nuclear disasters, Fukushima. There's still a lot going on over there. We'll get Kevin's thoughts on that.
I got to tell you, the Three Mile Island was so weird, Nate. You weren't even born then.
No, I was
but
not.
Louise and I went to see this movie, The China Syndrome,
mm-hmm.
with Jane Fonda or something. It's just and it's about this nuclear plant that goes into meltdown. And we come home from the movie, and Three Mile Island. Literally a few hours later, or maybe it was a day later, Three Mile Island goes down. It's like the entire country was just going, whoa! Anyhow, Nate Sweet. Thank you, Nate.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. We'll be back. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Levin here with you. Okay, here's why I think atheism is a religion and why I think agnosticism isn't. Now, first of all, let me preface all this by saying that this is a largely semantic argument. It's an argument about the meaning of words. And these words are, have a long history that is really ambiguous. But my understanding of these words is that agnostics are saying, I don't know. Is there Zeus that throws down thunderbolts? I don't know. When you die, do the lights just go out? I don't know. Wikipedia says my dad was an atheist. My recollection is that my dad was an agnostic. I may have said that he was an atheist at some point in time, but I frankly don't remember. But he was very much of the school of, I don't know, I think that when I die, the lights go out. But, I'll find out. An atheist, on the other hand, asserts positively all the evidence indicates there's no God, or at least no God the way that Christians asserted, or Jews asserted, or Buddhists or Muslims or whatever. And I would say that any positive assertion about a theistic notion is a religion. It constitutes a belief system that encompasses what happens when you die, that encompasses how you conduct your life. And it seems like life would be so much easier for the atheists if they simply, and I know at least one group has, declared themselves to be a religion. We are the Church of Atheism. We are the religion that asserts that there ain't nothing out there. It's all enlightened humanism. Or, you know, whatever. And I think I've said before, if I had to put myself into an ism immediately, I would say that I'm a Christian pantheist. I think that the entire universe is alive with intelligence. And intelligence is what is the entire universe. And I think Jesus said some really cool things, and I was raised in that church, and I like it. But, you know, what do you call it? I mean, you know, I can tell you there's a lot of Christians who would say I'm not a Christian. And there's probably a lot of pantheists who would say he's not a pantheist. So it's like, how can an atheist say, well, I know what an atheist is. But is atheism a religion? I think so. And I think it would be so much easier for David and his group. And, you know, he and I went around and around about this the last time he was on the show. And we're not going to convince each other. And I'm not. I hope this doesn't come across as my picking on him when he's not here to defend himself, because I'm really opposed to that. But I think I was fairly clear when he was on. I believe it's a religion, and life would be so much easier if they simply incorporated it as a religion, took advantage of all the nonprofit stuff that goes along with that, which I think they're doing already. But even beyond that, took advantage of the First Amendment protections that seem to be associated with being a religion. In fact, they might even qualify for faith-based initiative stuff, and they could do like Jerry Falwell does. Well, not Jerry's dead now, but, you know, Jerry Falwell's group, or Pat Robertson does. I mean, Pat Robertson became a billionaire, you know, in part this way. They could go to the federal government and get funding for their schools. Hey, we're going to create a school that, you know, an atheist school. Well, you can only get that funding if you're a church. We're going to start a food pantry, and we want to get some federal funds for it. You can only get that if you're a church. I mean, there's all this stuff that's available to religions. Why don't the atheists just come clean and say, hey, yeah, it's a religion. We have a worldview. We have a belief system. We, you know, part of our belief system is that we're not sure what we believe. Although, again, I would say that that's more of the agnostics. The atheists that I've met have been typically very certain of what they believe, which is absolutely, in my mind, an assertion of religious belief. All that said, the other point that I wanted to make before we hit the break, and then I'll pick up your calls on this when we come back from the break, is that one of the most aggressive and assertive forms of religious bigotry that is practiced in the United States right now is not the jihad that Christians have declared against Muslims, although that still continues. The, you know, all the hysteria over Fox News about the 9/11 mosque and oh my God, look out, and you know, is that guy in line with me at the airport you know, wearing a beard and a skull cap because he's Muslim? It's not that. That's not the. I don't think that that's the most aggressive and dastardly form of religious bigotry that's going on in America right now. And it's not even anti-Semitism, although anti-Semitism is still alive and well in this country and shows up a lot with these quote Southern groups and these you know, they used to call themselves the Klan. Now they've got new names. We had a guy on from the White People's Organization the other day, and And he was asserting that Jews aren't even white people. I'm like, what? But on top of all that, you've got anti-atheism bigotry. And the anti-atheism bigotry is, you know, I have friends who are atheists, you know, who are out about it. In other words, their atheism is their religion. I mean, they talk about it. They evangelize for it, which is another, you know, I used to say, evangelical atheism is a religion. Plain old atheism isn't. You know, I'm getting more nuanced in my old age here. But in any case, they take incredible amounts of guff for this. So check out David's organization, atheists.org. His party.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Their spring party that they're going to be having in Salt Lake City over Easter. That is what a hoot. Celebrating the goddess Ichthar. Hey, you can do that. Oh, this is going to be an interesting day. I can tell already. every single line is lit up. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, let the debate begin. Is atheism a religion? Is agnosticism not? Are, as David Silverman asserts, agnostics actually atheists? At one time I would have said in drag, but now I'm not sure if that's become a slur or not. What would you say? In costume? Say what? Incognito, yeah. No, it's kind of the opposite. It's the. And in any case, Rob in Chicago, you have some thoughts on this topic. Thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Thanks. I kind of disagree with your classification of atheism, and I also absolutely disagree with your last caller. I would call myself an agnostic. The difference between an agnostic and an atheist is that an atheist, if you would call yourself that, it only mirrors the dishonest certitude of religion, whereas a religion is the belief in a higher power, something bigger than yourself, whereas an agnostic would say they don't know. If all it takes is a belief system to be called a religion, then how is that any different than Democrats and Republicans? Because those are both belief systems. You should just be calling those a religion as well.
Well, those are political systems. You know, people don't worship or assert that there's nothing to worship. Well, actually, there are some people who worship George Bush and Barack Obama, I guess. But I think that most people can, you know, this we're getting into, what was it, Justice Potter? I forget which Supreme Court justice it was who said, you know, I can't identify pornography, but I know it when I see it. I'm not sure I can identify religion, but I know it when I see it, and or at least for me. And the characteristics that I see in a religion are an assertion of knowledge about how the world works, what our role is in the world, and what happens after we die. And I think probably the last of those three is the most significant signal that has to do with whether or not it's a religion. And Republicans and Democrats don't assert if you join our party, you're going to go to a particular place when you die. Although, you know, I realize there are some Republicans who say that if you're a Democrat, you know, whatever. But it's not an article of faith with them. So go ahead.
I would just like to say that an atheist believe in nothing. If you can't have a church of nothing, you know, that's almost kind of redundant in a way.
They're asserting a negative, which is an assertion, and that's my point. Is that when you make an assertion, as opposed to a question, you are taking a position. You are taking an affirmative position, even though it's an affirmative position about a negative. And it's like, you know, my arguing with somebody about
they're asserting that they know something, that's the basis for making it a religion.
They know something that has to do with what happens after you die, and how and the nature of life in the universe. Yes, that's my assertion. That's my religion. Rob, thank you for the call. Eric in Hollywood, Florida, your opinion on this?
Oh, yeah.
Eric, you still there?
Hey, I'm thankful for you. I'm grateful for your books and your dad and
thank you.
Everything that you represent, really. And the thing on Christianity, the thing that I've seen on Christianity that I personally experienced is on the bigotry part. And, about pushing people out, you know, the, mm-hmm. of the opinions of, you know, and it kind of makes the bigotry part kick in a lot more than what others see, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, let me form my opinion, but let me forgive, but let me have my opinion and not forgive, you know what I mean?
Yeah, my old friend Don Hoy, who has now passed away, used to say, you know, I consider myself a Christian, but I don't know any Christian church that would have me. Or words to that effect, and I think that there's, you know, we're there. And Eric, thanks for the call. This is where we're getting into the, you know, kind of what is a religion, not what is a religion, but what is your particular brand of it. Therese in Chicago, you think that science can be a religion?
Well, you know, I used to consider myself to be an atheist, and I based it on the same argument that your other caller was making, that if you can't prove it, it's not real.
Mm-hmm.
And I started really thinking about that about 20 years ago and doing a lot of research. I like to read and I'm kind of philosophical. And I realized that, and I have an example of it. I realized that there certainly could be so many parts of reality that science, as we have it right now, is not capable of proving. So that doesn't mean it's not real. It just means that science.
All right. We still haven't figured out how gravity works.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean we're all floating off the floor.
Right, right. And one of the examples I gave to a friend of mine who was kind of arguing about this at the time is I said, well, can you prove that a thought exists?
Aha.
Yeah, he said, no. And I'm like, well, does that mean it doesn't? I mean, you know you have thoughts. I know I have thoughts. There's no way to prove it, right?
Well, in fact, there is evidence of kind of the opposite, which is that when people are, you know, when they wire people up to brain devices that scan brain activity and they ask people to engage in decision making, the decision is made before they engage in the cognitive process of decision making, which means that, which questions free will. And there's a fairly large body of really good scientific literature on this very issue of, is there such a thing as free will? Do we think we are actually making decisions? But, you know, brain science indicates we're not. And
yeah.
which then gets into the whole realm of, you know, criminal justice and are people actually responsible for their acts. And then it gets very, very muddy. But interesting point, Therese. Thanks for the call. Chris in Englewood, Colorado, you disagree that atheism is a religion.
Yeah. Based on your rationale, not believing in Bigfoot is a religion.
If you organized a group of people who went around asserting that there's no Bigfoot, who built their lives around it, who believed that because they knew there was no Bigfoot, they had some certainty about what would happen after they died, I would not disagree with you. But I don't think that people who don't believe in Bigfoot have an organized epistemology like that.
Well, okay, I can't speak for all atheists or all agnostics like your previous guest presumed to do, but for myself and for everyone I know, we don't believe in God because there's absolutely no evidence to support it.
Right.
There's arguably just as much evidence or more that Bigfoot exists. The fact that you don't believe Bigfoot exists because the evidence is poor at best doesn't make that your religion. I'm not really talking about the epistemology. I'm talking about simple critical thinking. If there's no evidence to believe in something and you believe in it anyway, that's
right.
Faith and that's religion. Not
right.
Believing something because there's no evidence for it does not make that position a religion.
Well, I understand that that's the argument that's typically made, but if you are asserting that as a certainty, I would say that you are engaging in religion. If you're asserting that as a possibility, then I'd say you're engaging in logic.
Well, I would say that most that's...
Which are you doing?
That is the difference between agnostics and atheists. I don't believe in God because there's no evidence to support it.
So do you believe that you don't believe in God? Are you certain that there's no God?
No, of course I'm not. If
okay.
It came to light that there was a God, I believe in God. But
then
the entire concept of religion goes out the door because there's no more faith. We now know that there's a God.
Okay, so you're asserting agnosticism, not atheism.
Well, what I'm asserting is that agnosticism and atheism is absolutely not a religion, and I think it's kind of, you know, silly to say so.
Okay. All right. We'll agree to disagree. Chris, thanks for listening to 760 AM. Dan, listening to 90.3 FM in Moscow, Pennsylvania. Hey, Dan, what's up?
There's two words that I think are important, faith and belief.
Right.
And atheist, I think, I don't know, I'm not one, believes. therefore has faith that there's no God, just like a religious person believes that there is a God, if he has faith. So I think faith's a key word in this argument.
Well, that's my point, is if you're asserting certainty about something that nobody can be certain about, then you're asserting a religion, whether it's an affirmative or a negative religion. You're still, that makes it a religion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, religions have faith. Faith is believing something that you can't prove. That's faith.
Right. Faith that after you die, you're going to go someplace. Faith that after you die, the lights are going to go off. It's still faith. It's still an assertion of a belief system because you don't know. And Dan, thanks for the call. Eric in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Eric.
Hey, Todd, how are we doing? All right, listen, first I got to blow all your minds. What if Bigfoot turns out to be God?
Ha!
Just asking. But anyway, I want to set...
You've just started a new church, Eric.
Well, listen, I want my tax-free status. Our first field trip is going to be to Falwell's grave.
There you go.
But in any event, the bigotry aspect, you touched on it earlier about it not being so much between the varying sects, but they have in common the dislike for us, infidel non-believers. I do count myself among the agnostics.
Right.
And I think I have to agree that, at least in part, atheism meets the description of religion because it has a set dogma.
At least in assertive or in evangelical atheism,
right.
An atheism that has an annual convention. That's a religion.
Right, and there are rules. There are set rules. But the real word, if you want to distinguish between atheist and agnostic, which you can put agnostic against every sect, including atheist, is the hubris that they have. Their insistence on their system of belief, whatever it is, that it provides for a deity or that there is not one.
Yeah, I would, hubris is typically a pejorative, so I would be reluctant to use the word, but I understand where you're coming from. I just use the word certainty, and I think that satisfies it. But point made, Eric. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So if you assert that there's nothing out there, in my opinion, you are religious. Welcome back. Let's continue this conversation. Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You wanted to talk about agnosticism?
Tom, for taking my call. I would say Socrates was considered an agnostic in the fact that he didn't take one way or the other, the left or the right.
But look at the gods that he had to choose from. I mean, today we consider them pretty silly.
Yeah, and some chose, and exactly that, some chose the god of Moses and some chose other gods. But let me say this, in addition to that, there's so much evidence pointing to the idea of God that we've been given, and the religion just isn't so. If you look at some of the discoveries of the Sumerian clay tablets, for example, or even the most latest, the Nobel Peace Prize given to the discoveries of the Higgs boson,
yeah.
That they just discovered this field that everything is projected onto. Imagine our history as a recorder, a program, a game that you left on and it just repeats itself over and over again until you shut it off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So everything, immortality is just a definition of our perspective of time. From one place to the other, it may take 3 hours for some people, but imagine a place where 3 hours may actually be 20 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, for some, I consider how time must be perceived by a fruit fly that has a lifespan of 5 days, right? Every day is one-fifth of their life. Well, one-fifth of my life, one-fifth of the average human's life is somewhere between 15 and 20 years. So,
and it's a good thing I'm not a fruit fly.
Yeah, well, or does a fruit fly experience time super slowed down? I mean, if you watch a fruit fly flying, their little wings are moving a whole lot faster than you or I can move our arms. It may be that they don't experience it at that speed. They actually experience it as flap, 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 flap. And so the 5 days that they live seems to them like 50 years.
Yeah, so we have the discoveries of Zachariah Sitchin and Michael Cremo, and they all this evidence and the gentleman who discovered the Higgs boson particle or the Higgs boson field, that everything in our projection of reality is like a recording. It's just going to keep continuing. And
right.
The past is evidence of the our present and our future. I think Dick Gregory said it once that we're always told through all these great science fiction movies, I would say, what has been done, what is being done, and what is going to happen.
Right. Right. And what does that have to do with religion?
Well, religion itself, the three main religions, I have to say, are the culprits in presenting to us this idea of God, that perhaps this program involves entities from within our galaxy or solar system, but just on a different axis or elliptical orbit, such as is mentioned by Zechariah Sitchin.
You're taking the Scientologist perspective that people from the planet Theta seeded the Earth 10,000 years ago?
That I would take the perspective that the Sumerian tablets that were written thousands of years before any of the...
Right, 6,000 years ago.
Yeah, that they present to us a view of history that may repeat itself once again.
So you're with Eric Von Däniken and the Chariots of the Gods, that whole thing.
I think there is definitely some fact.
I read those books back in the 60s or 70s whenever they came out, and I thought, wow, this is amazing stuff. I still don't know. Michael, thank you for the call. Thank you very much. 10 minutes before. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Oh, my. Michelle in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Michelle, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, to follow up with a couple previous callers, I don't want to overlap too much, but a couple points I think the last caller brought up. I understand the semantical argument between atheist and agnostic.
Right.
And I look at it a little bit like the way physics used to see the world as space-time were two separate things.
Right.
And now we talk about space-time in a continuum.
Right.
And I think atheism and agnosticism can be seen in sort of the same sort of way. And I think it just comes down to people that are comfortable with ambiguity as opposed to certainty.
Oh, that's interesting. And so if you require certainty in your world, you become and you don't believe in a theistic presence, a deity, then or
lean on science.
Then you become an atheist. Whereas if you're comfortable with ambiguity, you become an agnostic. To use my definitions of these words, which are not.
Possibly because I think an agnostic would allow faith as proof, whereas an atheist wouldn't.
Right.
And then also in regards to the definition of a religion, I think the one word that's been left out here is the practice of ritual.
Yeah.
And that's a huge part of the religion. And then to parse it even further, atheist/agnostics, space, time. There's also a difference between a believer and a religious practitioner. Those are not also mutually inclusive.
Right. So you're asserting that this is not binary. It's a continuum. And
absolutely.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think one of the limitations we have as human beings is that we see the world, and this it goes a little bit to the fruit fly argument with the space time.
Right.
That we see the world as born, live, die, begin, middle, end, where perhaps that's absolutely not the way the universe works at all.
Yeah, no, my personal belief is that consciousness has existed for, you know, from the beginning and whatever the beginning was, and that at some deep level, all of our consciousnesses is just a reflection of some larger universal consciousness. You know, somebody called the show once and said, go to YouTube and type in large structures of the universe. I did. And it's mind blowing because they show the large, you know, this little slice of the universe. And it's like looking at a piece of brain. It's you're looking at neural networks. And
that might be anthropomorphism projected upon.
You're right. It could be entirely anthropomorphic. But on the other hand, it could also be true. I mean, it could be that the universe is a conscious system, not necessarily self-conscious, but conscious.
Okay, and that's a huge difference between self-conscious and conscious, and I think that also goes to the heart of the difference between a belief in a conscious God or a belief in just an energy, a force, a dark matter. You know,
right. Now you're making, and the latter is the argument that Jefferson and Franklin made in defense of deism. If you go back and you look at their writings and the deism. Michelle, thank you for the call. Let me get some more folks in here. There's a lot of people who want to participate in this conversation. David in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, David.
Hey, and I like your show a lot, but I always get a little weirded out when you get into this religion, atheist stuff.
Because
I'm a non-believer, but I don't necessarily use the atheist term just because I think that's more of a label imposed on non-believers.
Okay.
But I think any thought of religion or belief is a personal thing outward only. I don't think that you have the right to impose a label on my belief system. If I say I'm a non-believer, you have to accept me at what I am.
I do.
Just as I would accept you if you are a believer.
I absolutely do, but I would further assert that if your non-belief becomes evangelical, that you're engaging in religion.
Because I don't openly say this to anyone, because the profession I have, I don't talk religion ever to anyone.
Right.
I'm a closet non-believer. But the point is that, you know, religion as just a basic definition, you know, is a very broad thing. But once you're talking about a person, it is now a specific belief system, and you have to accept someone at their belief. I mean, if you say you are anything, if that's your personal belief system. So I don't have a right to label that as a religion or a political belief or anything.
Well, I think we all, you know, David, we all have the right to identify anything or anybody and come up with any label we want. What we don't have the right to do is to engage in behavior that harms those people. I mean, you have the right to call or think of me as anything, but if you're my bank, you don't have the right to, based on that belief, refuse to notarize a document for me, in my opinion.
I feel like a lot of what you're doing is mostly just wordplay, though. I mean, when you say, well, you don't believe anything, so that itself is a belief, therefore that is a religion.
Well, I started out by saying this was a semantic argument. This is an argument about what words mean. This entire thing is a semantic argument.
If you go strictly on a dictionary, it does not say lack of belief.
Well, no, it depends on the dictionary you look at. And you know, and this is the thing. Whenever I have this conversation, I'll get like, you know, 20 emails from people, and if, you know, half of them are saying one thing, half. In any case, David, thank you for the call. Seth in Blacksburg, Virginia, you wanted to talk about religion versus spirituality.
Well, I just have a quick comment about that, but I've got another comment that's more important.
Okay.
Religion generally is what holy people explain to the masses about the pathway to salvation, while spirituality is what you internally believe as your own
belief or experience.
Yeah, your own experience. Yeah.
Right.
But the main point that I wanted to get across is that for atheists and agnostics, or people that don't believe, the chakra system is a conduit to understanding spirituality and God that is universal for all people.
You're talking the seven chakras that Hinduism identifies, going from the base of the spine to the crown of the head?
Right, but it's not just Hinduism, it's anybody. We all have nerve glands along the spine that opens the spirit within ourselves, and anybody has options about. And Qigong is an easy way to understand that system. So I think it's a
well organized system that explains a lot, but it's also part of the religion. Seth, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And Mike Papantonio, America's lawyer, is on the line with us, host of Ring of Fire Radio and attorney at Levin Law, ringoffireradio.com, of course, the website, and at Ring of Fire Radio, the Twitter feed. Hey, Pap, how you doing?
Tom, how are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. This Hobby Lobby case yesterday was interesting. And then on top of that, now we find out, in another area, I guess, altogether, that Wells Fargo actually has a manual for how to screw customers. I mean, there's just stuff laying all over the ground here for you to go off on. What?
Well, the Wells Fargo case I thought was extremely interesting to me because I've been working these cases for so long against the various banks for all types of schemes. I recall I put together a short list of the stories that we've done on Ring of Fire and that you've done these stories on Wall Street bankers. Just a quick list, a fraction of the stories. Bank of America for fraud was hit for $9.3 billion for stealing, for lying to Fannie Mae, basically. You had Citigroup, $590 million also hit for fraud, because they were selling toxic subprime debt that they knew was toxic and they knew it was all a lie. JP Morgan hit for $150 million in fraud for the very same thing. Bank of America, another case, hit for $137 million for fraud. They had to confess to being criminals. They had to confess to being an admitted felon. Goldman Sachs Group hit for $60 million also for fraud. HSBC, $1.9 billion for laundering money for drug cartels and terrorists. And you know what all of them have in common is nobody went to jail. And the same thing will happen. This Wells Fargo case is deplorable. They had a handbook that basically told the lawyers working for Wells Fargo. First of all, I have real problems with the caliber of lawyer that would do this, but they seem to be able to hire them by the dozens, by the hundreds. They had a handbook for that lawyer that told the lawyer how to phony up and make up a claim by just creating signatures, by signing off on signatures and saying that this is a signature of the person who signed the mortgage. Now, the reason they did that is because they were trying to foreclose on people's homes. In order to foreclose, they had to have this document signed. It had to be attached with very specific kinds of documents. And you know what, Tom? It all had to happen within 90 days. All this was supposed to be put together within 90 days from the time that the mortgage closed. Now, they knew they couldn't do that because the mortgages had been bundled up in things called toxic derivatives, and they were sold all over the country, so nobody knew where the mortgage was. Nobody had the signature. Nobody could even prove that Wells Fargo owned the bank, so they just made stuff up. And they forged signatures, they created documents out of thin air, and then at the end of the game, they kicked people out of their houses based on fraud.
And the signatures, my understanding of this, Pap, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the signatures that had to be on these documents, or the documents themselves that had to exist and be signed, were documents that were part of the initial closing process when the person bought the house.
That's right. That's right.
And if it was. So why are we not seeing law firms on TV right now? I mean, last night I was watching TV and I saw an ad for a local law firm that said, are you taking testosterone? And if you are taking testosterone and you have had a stroke or a heart attack or a loved one of yours is taking testosterone and has died, you may be entitled to compensation. Call the so-and-so law firm, and here's their phone number. Why am I not seeing ads like that on TV that start out by saying, have you had your home foreclosed on by your bank? If you have, then call this number because we may be able to sue these bastards.
This litigation really takes on the form more of a class action, Tom. It means that what you have is you have a claim that's common to a lot of different people. And here's the commonality. The commonality is that this company, Wells Fargo, phonied up these documents. They knew they were lying. They instructed their lawyers to lie. They instructed their lawyers to sign off on documents that were a lie. And the results were, because of that lie, people were kicked out of their home. Now, that's a class action kind of, it's very difficult to take these cases one at a time, okay? So what you'll see, potentially you could, there's no question.
There's not large money involved like there is if somebody dies or has a stroke.
It's not that it's not a business decision. The business decision for a lawyer is, you have somebody who was kicked out of their home based on a fraudulent document, and because they were kicked out of their home, the defense of statute of limitations. In other words, if this all had to be done within 90 days, and it, in fact it was done 2 years later, the defense of we own your home, you owe us money, is waived. It's just like a statute of limitation. So if they owed $150,000 on the home, the argument could be made that they gained $150,000. But the point is, from a standpoint of you typically see these cases form up and by way of a class action, and where you have all of the discovery that takes place by one committee of attorneys. That committee of attorneys determines the disgusting conduct of this particular company affects all of these people.
Why is it not possible? And please forgive my ignorance on this, but why is it not possible that if X number of people, and let's assume it's, you know, millions of people, during the period from when Phil Graham got the Commodity Futures Modernization Act passed in what, I think 99 or 2000, and, you know, that made most of the stuff possible, and Graham Leach Bliley, there was this period of 7 or 8 years where, and not just banks, but these local businesses, loan originators, were selling mortgages to people that on their face were fraudulent, and now people find themselves, you know, somebody's got a $30,000 mortgage, somebody else has a $300,000 mortgage. Why not just say, if you have a mortgage and it was one of these phony baloney mortgages where they were just trying to get as many as they could so that they could tranche them together, so that they could bundle them together and turn them into, you know, the derivatives and make billions of dollars off millions of dollars worth of assets, that you don't owe that money anymore. You know, a jubilee, basically. You are free and clear. You own your home.
There are a couple of those cases winding through the courts right now. The problem is the courts have been over backwards, Tom.
On behalf of the banks,
there's no question. This particular case that you're talking about, this Wells Fargo case, is brought in a horrible jurisdiction. It's going to be northern district there in New York. Historically, they always line up with Wall Street, with banks, and that's just a product of the fact that we have been asleep at the wheel as progressives, and we've allowed the Republicans to pack the courts to the point to where you have about, at this point, it's well over 70% of the courts are packed with corporate leaning, very conservative Republican judges. And so it's been a real slog for the lawyers who have gone forward with those types of theories that you're talking about. It's been very difficult.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, the only people who've really accomplished anything is the government, because the government says all you have to do is pay us money and these 10 people won't go to jail. Basically, they simply say either pay us the money or we're going to throw you in jail.
Right. And so, but that doesn't help the homeowner. That's the government.
Matter of fact, the settlements that the government has entered with these companies helps the homeowner almost zero most of the time.
This is a tragedy.
So it's a terrible tragedy, and it's a combination of packed courts and the unwillingness for an attorney to say, you know, I can't do the impossible in front of this judge or that judge. That's kind of where we are to some degree.
Thank you for so enlightening us. America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com. Thanks, Pap.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Mike Papantonio's website over at ringoffireradio.com. And welcome back, 15 minutes past the hour, and Mike Papantonio is still with us. Let's talk about your Ring of Fire TV show that's coming up this Sunday here on Free Speech TV at noon Eastern time, and it gets replayed every day throughout the week. Check your local listings and ringoffireradio.com. What's up?
We're going to be talking about how investing in America's infrastructure can actually help the economy. We're going to be talking about the GOP's endless efforts to rig the system on voting. I'm going to try to do a little bit of a discussion pre-Hobby Lobby, which I think now is a case that's just on everybody's mind. We have a different angle on it. I don't know if it'll be on this Sunday show, but we're going to be talking about if the Supreme Court goes forward and they grant the Hobby Lobby relief based on constitutional religious grounds, what that does, Tom, is it gets further to piercing the veil of the corporate protection. What I mean by that is right now a corporation separates, that is called separateness. It separates the individual who owns the corporation from the corporate entity. Let's take Hobby Lobby. You have the Green family that owns the corporation. They're maintaining that the corporation has a constitutional rights to religious protection. At what point do you say that there's no distinction, there's no separateness between the corporate entity and the individual?
And therefore the limitation of liability gets blown up.
Exactly. Therefore, you can pierce the corporate veil. You can move against the liability. You can. What I will be doing if the Supreme Court gives us the chance, which they won't do, I can tell you that the corporate America hates this. Corporate America has not put one amicus brief into this discussion at all. Corporate America and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is terrified that this ridiculous Supreme Court majority just might be goofy enough to push the ball to saying the corporation is such a person that they not only have a First Amendment right, they have a religious protection, they maybe down the road have a Fourth Amendment right, who knows? But the closer you get to that, the more you're able to say there is no separateness, there is no reason why you can't sue Mr. Green right along with the corporation, and that wall that's supposed to protect Mr. Green then disappears.
Right. Well, and the court has asserted that there's that First Amendment right of free speech for corporations and the 14th Amendment right of equal protection. I mean, those were Buckley and First National Bank came together in Citizens United. But they've also asserted that there's the Fifth Amendment protection against double jeopardy that corporations have as well.
Well,
so that's three.
Well, and then you've got the Fourth Amendment. They're actually trying to test the Fourth Amendment on things like search and seizure.
Right.
You know. So.
Oh,
so
in fact, Dow Chemical did that in the 70s or 80s. The EPA flew a plane over their building because the whistleblower said that they were gassing out benzene. They flew a plane over, took pictures of it, and they took them to court. And Dow actually won that case because the evidence got thrown out.
Yeah, they won on different grounds, though. I don't think it wasn't a straight up Fourth Amendment. But the closer you get to saying, look, I don't see the distinction here. If a corporation is a person, heck, we can start throwing them in jail. We can do that. You know, we can sue them. They are just another person. You'll see this court go out of their way to try to avoid making this a constitutional issue that's going to put them there. The Fortune 500 companies, not one of them filed an amicus brief.
That's fascinating.
The U.S. Chamber of Commerce did not. Yeah.
That's fascinating. Mike Papantonio, Ring of Fire TV, right here on Free Speech TV, noon Eastern time on Sundays, and you know, then repeated throughout the week. Pap, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
America's Lawyer. Check it out at ringoffireradio.com. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. And the chat room really roaring along. So is Twitter. So is our website. That's interesting. Michael J. Rice, I was listening to Tom's definition of faith, and what occurred to me is that faith is an unreasonable act. That being said, when is it okay to be unreasonable? It's always okay to be unreasonable as long as you're not being unreasonable in a way that harms another person. And this is where, you know, this person said earlier to me, you have no right to label my belief system. I'm like, yeah, I have every right to label it. What I don't have the right to do is to harm you based on that labeling. If even naming you that way harms you, and there are words that we can, that, you know, typically ethnic, religious, or racial slurs do that, that speech can harm people, then, you know, you've got a case. I think the name of the NFL sports team here in Washington, D.C., for example, is, you know, case in point. Dan Snyder, I think, is the name of the team's owner. Had to run off and find some Indian group that was willing to dress up in that team's uniform or paraphernalia thereof and have their picture taken, and then he gave them some goodies. I mean, that strikes me as really kind of a desperate act. Marion Delgado in the chat room quoting Thomas Jefferson, and it's such a great quote. He says, "It does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg." But there is a point where it does pick your pocket or break your leg. Right now you've got churches all across the United States taking our tax dollars, picking our pockets in these so-called faith-based initiatives that originated during the Reagan administration and got actually radically increased during the Clinton administration. These faith-based initiatives that represent a transfer of tens to hundreds of billions of dollars every year from federal government to religious institutions. And in addition to that, you've got religious institutions that are getting away with not paying taxes to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. So, why don't atheists say, yeah, okay, I got, you know, I've created the Church of Atheism. My home is the rectory. I no longer have to pay property taxes on my house. I mean, at what point, this is a little like, you know, the Hobby Lobby thing, corporations or people. Mike Papantoni was just talking about how corporate America is really frightened by the Hobby Lobby thing because the Supreme Court might be just wackadoodle enough to say, sure, they got a religion. And at some point, the Supreme Court has already given corporations First Amendment rights of free speech, 14th Amendment rights of equal protection, and Fifth Amendment rights against double jeopardy. At what point will somebody be able to successfully say, you know, that limitation of liability, LLC, that limitation of liability that you get when you incorporate? I mean, this was the whole reason why the modern corporate form was invented by Queen Elizabeth I, or maybe it was King James who preceded her. No, James followed her. Anyway, I think it was Queen Elizabeth I in like 1597, if my recollection is correct, when Sir Francis Drake was trying to get together money for the Golden Hind. And he was going to sail around the world. And Queen Elizabeth was trying to raise money for this. And so she went out to investors and they said, well, you know, I'll put in $1,000 or pounds or whatever, pounds sterling there. But what happens if this guy, you know, if he aggregates our, you know, million pounds and you know, now has enough money to do his tour around the world? But what happens if he blunders into France and does some damage to a French merchant vessel or something that's more than $1 million worth of damage? They're going to come after me and they're going to sue me. And I, you know, I'd like some limitation of liability here. And so Queen Elizabeth I said, OK, the limited, you know, we're going to create this thing called a corporation. The form already sort of existed in the form of the Dutch shipping companies going back to the 1400s. But she made it very clear and very explicit, created this law, said, we're going to limit your liability to the amount of your investment. So right now, for example, if you buy $1,000 worth of shares in Bank of America and you own a piece of Bank of America, and Bank of America tomorrow goes not just bankrupt, but owes billions of dollars because of all the fraudulent mortgages that they did or some other fraud that these banks are always doing. Right now, the limitation of your liability is the $1,000 that you paid for the stock. The stock is worthless. You lose the $1,000, but that's it. But if you could successfully do what's called piercing the corporate veil and say, this bank is a person, not a corporation, they do not have limitations of liability because they are asserting religious rights, they're asserting free speech rights, they're asserting equal protection rights, they're asserting double jeopardy rights, they're asserting rights of privacy, and therefore, this limitation of liability that they're asserting no longer stands. They have stopped being a corporation and they have started being a person, and a person can have unlimited liability. I mean, we're starting to see functionally debtors' prisons in the United States now, where people, you know, creditors go after individuals and try to get them to show up in court for even very small things. People say, ah, screw that, I'm not going to show up, or they don't even know that there's a court date, and then the creditor goes into court and says, please issue a bench warrant for this guy. And bang, you're in jail because you didn't pay a hospital bill you didn't know existed. So how does a corporation avoid that? Well, they say, or a stockholder, an investor avoid that? Well, they say, we're limited in our liability. LLC, limited liability corporation. We're limited in our liability. And at some point, the Supreme Court is going to go so far in making corporations people that somebody, some smart lawyer is going to come along and say, you know, those limitations of liability are nonsense. Now, if a corporation can have a religion, can they be atheist?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, Hobby Lobby's asserting their Christianity, their Catholicism or whatever it is, fundamentalism. Couldn't some corporation assert their atheism? It's the good, the bad, and the very, very Icarianly ugly, brought to you by the organic wine company, EcoWine.com. The good. The National Labor Relations Board, that agency scored a touchdown for the labor movement on Wednesday when one of its regional directors okayed a move by football players at Northwestern University to form a union. The move, which put a cap on a months-long campaign led by senior quarterback Kane Coulter, has the chance to fundamentally transform college sports. Right now, even though they make billions of dollars for their schools, college athletes are considered amateur athletes and cannot earn a salary. If they are able to unionize, however, college athletes will be able to collectively bargain for salaries and benefits. Everyone, no matter where they work, deserves the right to unionize. Good on the NLRB for making that possible for Northwestern's football players. The bad. Edward Farrell. On Monday, the vice mayor of Maricopa, Arizona, posted an obituary to his Facebook page that championed the late Fred Phelps as, quote, the man who forever stopped the march of gay rights, end quote. And while Farrell's admiration for Phelps is bad enough, it turns out the article he posted wasn't actually a real article. It was a satirical piece published in The Onion. Apparently, Vice Mayor Farrell was too blinded by his love for a hateful bigot to know the difference. And the very, very ugly Sean Hannity. During Wednesday's broadcast of his radio show, the conservative pundit and Fox News host blasted Obamacare's birth control mandate. He said it was ridiculous for people to expect other people to subsidize their birth control when they can walk into a bar and grab condoms for free. Seriously, this is his health insurance plan. Take a listen.
Lanny, in every bar just about in New York now, you can get condoms. Guess how much they cost?
Yes, but
nothing.
They're much less effective than wealthy people can afford almost 99% of.
Lanny, you can go online. I urge you to go online, and I want you to Google.
That we have to be sensitive to.
I want you to Google condoms online and how much they cost and the different types you can get. I want you to go online, Google condoms and how much they cost and the different brands you can get and all sorts of varieties and how inexpensive they are.
I think Sean Hannity is spending too much time in New York City's bars. And he clearly never passed sex ed. Condoms are nowhere near as reliable as other more expensive forms of birth control. The sad thing is that Sean's argument about condoms isn't all that different from the mainstream conservative take on Obamacare's birth control mandate, and that is very, very ugly. Walk into any bar in New York? How do you know these things? I mean, last night I watched Fox News for, was it last night or the night before? It might have been the night before, for like 10 minutes. You know, I was like, one of the other stations I was watching went to a commercial, so I started channel surfing, and there's Fox. And Hannity is like going out of a segment, and he makes some comment about online porn. Literally into the bump. And I'm going, really? You watch online porn? I mean, it's or what? I mean, what was the point? I think he was saying something about, you know, any kid can access online porn. Well, yeah, but anyway, Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, you want to get back to, is atheism a religion?
Well, I was a little bit troubled by some of the arguments offered up, and obviously, when we talk about religion, you know, it can very quickly accelerate into a sort of nebulous discussion. But this notion that you've got two different perspectives, one that says, you know, atheism or agnosticism, where you question, and that's underlined by the scientific method and the principles therein. And on the other side, you know, well, you know, you can't explain to me what happens after I die, so therefore, you know, it grants validity to my perspective that there's an afterlife and a God and a higher power.
No, that was not my assertion.
No, I'm not saying you're saying it. I'm saying this is what I've been hearing from people.
Okay.
Given what they've said, that's the implication. You know, it's not up to science to prove a negative. You know, if you want to assert that the world is flat, fine. But, you know, it's not up to me to disprove that. You know, you're the one who has to prove that contention. And that's how science works. So the notion that because science can't tell you what happens after you die, that legitimizes or validates religion, is simply not the case. It's that defies the scientific method in terms of how we function in the world in which we live. So if you reject science entirely, fine, make that argument. But, you know, don't embrace science on the one hand and then throw it out the window when it's not convenient in terms of your philosophy with regard to religion. So I think that's an important point. And also this notion about, you know, I remember when you had that caller who called in and said, you know, well, you know, look at pictures of the universe and then look at pictures of the human brain.
Right.
Well, it turns out that, you know, what's more likely, you know, and again, given, you know, the tenet of Occam's razor, you know, what's more likely, that there's some sort of relationship there, or that we know, given what we've studied, that the human brain looks for patterns and that we are programmed to see patterns. So what's more likely, that what I'm imposing that view of the brain as a connection to some consciousness in the universe or vice versa, or that, you know, that frankly I'm looking for a pattern that isn't there, but my brain is programmed to do so.
Well, I think actually if you look at nature, what's more likely is that we are fractal images of the universe. I mean, there are these mathematical sets. The Mandelbrot set is, you know, one of the more famous ones, but there's a more fundamental one. I'm forgetting the name of the guy who invented it or discovered it. But it's a series of numbers that you can put together in a formula, and it always produces the same geometric result. And that geometric result looks like a nautilus shell. And that is totally fractal. So it seems to me that if you look at nature, you know, from the large giant cauliflower, then you look at the little individual flowers of the cauliflower, and then you look at the individual pieces of the cauliflower, and you keep getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and you see the identical pattern over and over and over again, that if you're looking at the pattern of neural interconnections in our brain, and you're looking at the pattern of, interaction between celestial bodies that might be using, I mean, it's not, they're not communicating by virtue of serotonin and dopamine. They're communicating by virtue, they may be communicating and I use that word very loosely, by virtue of gravity or electromagnetic radiation.
Yes. That's something very different. I mean, you know, again, we know, you know, that there, the forces in the universe, things like gravity, strong nuclear bound, weak nuclear, these sorts of things, you know. But, I mean, that's different than what that caller suggested. You know, when he called in.
Well, that's how I took it. The way I'm choosing to take that, you know, what I learned when I saw that is that the universe and our brain are fractal images of each other. And it's not just our brain, fruit fly's brain too.
Well, I think that's more of the case that, again, we're programmed to see patterns, and that's the way that we evolve.
Yeah.
I mean, this is why, you know.
Well, you're right.
The last point, and that is that, you know, there are a lot of other researchers who are also looking at, you know, this question of the God gene. In other words, to the best of our knowledge, we're the only species on the planet that has developed a sophisticated consciousness such that we perceive time in a linear fashion. My 7-year-old dog doesn't sit around to the best of science, what science knows, and wondering, you know, where he is in terms of his being.
No, but what we do know is that elephants have funerals. They bury their dead, they mourn their dead, and for decades later, they treat that burial site the way that we would treat a sacred site. They treat it differently from every place else.
Exactly, but again, to the question of the research that's being done and whether or not we are programmed to, in fact, seek out a higher power, because once our species, or, you know, if you want to put elephants in that category as well, that's fine. Once a species develops the sense to perceive time, you know, in order to remain sane, it's argued that they need to then create a universe, a higher power in that universe, so that they can rationalize their existence. Otherwise, you know, it doesn't make any
sense.
Yeah,
see, I discard that argument. I don't think that we're the only species that's aware of time, and I don't think that our awareness of time necessitates, you know, creation myths.
Well, I mean, again, that's the argument that I'm telling you that exists in terms of research. I mean,
yeah.
You know, are we evolutionarily programmed to perceive time such that, you know, once we do, that, you know, unlike other species that don't, you know, that we then have to create.
But how do we know that other species don't perceive time? I mean, you know, they're...
Because we have these fields called zoology and anthropology.
No. They have been able to communicate now. You've got chimps and some other primates that have vocabularies of, you know, 20 to 300 words, and they can communicate concepts of time. Tonight, I want, you know, future and past. Tonight, I want to have a grape.
Well, but using that argument, and we can go extend it to the absurd. I mean, a fruit fly then has a concept of time.
I think it's possible.
I think
it's probable.
You think it's probable that a fruit fly sits around and thinks about being middle aged?
It may well be. I mean, when a fruit fly notices that, you know, he doesn't fly as fast as he used to, he might, you know, go through a period of a midlife crisis, you know, get a sports car and a girlfriend. I don't know. Steve, thank you for the call. I think we've kind of exhausted this one, but we will continue. It's 15 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. Do fruit flies have midlife crises? Do fruit flies experience time? Do fruit flies... Oh, man. Is there a fruit fly Rush Limbaugh out there who's taking Viagra? I don't know. Maybe.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Shano nailed it. Fruit flies don't have midlife crises. They have mid-flight crises. We'll be back. Welcome back. Alberto in Greenfield, California, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Alberto, you wanted to talk about naturalism?
Yes. I think that we need to separate two issues when the atheism religion debate. The first is whether atheists should call themselves or call what they believe in.
Mm-hmm.
And you may be right that for practical purposes, for political reasons, it would be a good idea for them to call themselves a religion. But the issue that you raise is whether atheism is in fact a religion.
Right.
And I think the answer is clearly no. And there are two arguments that I want to raise. The first is just based on the etymological meaning of the term. And I should point out that I'm actually a philosopher, so I'm actually writing an article on this at the moment. But
so this is your business to ponder these things.
Yes.
Exactly. Either your vocation or your avocation, or both.
I would say both.
Yeah.
So the etymological meaning of the term just means without God, right? He means without, and the Greek word theos means God. So literally the term just means a lack of belief or a negation of theos.
Actually, theos is plural, isn't it? Doesn't it mean without gods?
Sure, yes. It means without God. So it's basically, the way it's used today, it usually just means universal negation, right, of any deities. But the term atheism can be misleading because it seems to be a label like the label Christian, Muslim, or string theorist. Mm-hmm. But really the term atheism is more a label like a unicornist. To be an a unicornist is to not believe in any unicorn. So it doesn't tell you anything about what an a unicornist believes. And similarly with an atheist, to be an atheist is not to necessarily believe anything. You can't infer anything from that fact alone. It doesn't entail any positive beliefs. And for that reason, atheism is compatible with religious and non-religious. You know, you can be an atheist and believe in an afterlife. And as long as you don't believe in and ascribe it to a god, that's a compatible belief with atheism. Similarly, you can be a Buddhist or a Taoist. Some forms of Buddhism don't have any deities, and yet they're atheists, but yet they're also religious.
Right.
So it's compatible with religious belief, but where naturalism comes in is that I think what you're conflating is atheism with naturalism. And naturalism is the belief that the universe is a closed system, mm-hmm. that there are no supernatural entities, not only deities like gods, but no afterlife, no anything like that, no rewards and punishments at the end of death. Nothing like that, no cosmic. And so naturalism does entail a bunch of positive beliefs. It entails the scientific method, that we live in a mechanistic universe, that there are fixed laws. And naturalism then is broader than atheism, and it entails or implies atheism. But not all atheists have to be naturalists, because as we've already pointed out, they can also be religious. So I think that there's a...
Isn't that an argument? I mean, you're bumping up against my pantheism here, aren't you?
Sure. Pantheist, I guess, by definition, would be a form of naturalism, because pantheists believe that everything is God.
Right. Actually, pantheists believe that God is in everything.
Okay, sure.
So it's a reverse of the logic. Speaking of plurality, by the way, here's a joke for you. A Roman walks into a bar and asks for a Martinus. You mean a martini, the bartender says? The Roman replies, if I wanted a double, I would have asked for it. Alberto, thank you for the call. Good talking with you. We'll be back. 10 minutes before the hour, we have no talk radio news today because Ellen Ratner is in China, which I'm sure we'll hear interesting stories about when she returns. So I'm going to continue with our phone calls. Tom in Holyoke, Colorado. Hey, Tom. Religion?
Hi. Yes, Tom. I believe that if there are 7 billion conscious people, then there are 7 billion religions. It would come down to each individual's spiritual connection with God if it does not hurt themselves or someone else.
Right, but this whole discussion started with the head, David Silverman, the head of the American Atheists, going into a bank and saying, would you please notarize, my signature? And the notary saying, essentially through her behavior, that she doesn't like atheists and she's not going to do it. And I'm asserting, and I think David is asserting, that that's a form of religious bigotry. And so for these purposes, and for the purposes of most conversations about religion, it's useful to aggregate people so that they can have some kind of status at law. Am I making sense? But I get your point that each one of us experiences life,
yes.
The universe and religion in a unique way. And I don't disagree with that at all. That makes perfect sense. The Jordans in Frankfort, Kentucky. You wanted to bring up Hobby Lobby?
Yes, sir, Tom. This is the Jordans. We're a couple of young guys. We discovered you 4 or 5 months ago, and we both really like your program.
Thank you.
But we believe pretty much diametrically opposed to you on everything,
okay,
including the Hobby Lobby page.
All right.
I'm sorry?
That's fine. That's great. So what, yes, do you disagree with me about with regard to Hobby Lobby?
Well, in this particular case, it's being brought by David Green, who's the owner of Hobby Lobby. Hobby Lobby is a privately held corporation, and the real crux of this case is, does David Green have the rights to not have to provide contraception to his employees?
That's not the assertion he's making in court.
What assertion is he making in court?
The assertion he's making in court is that Hobby Lobby, as a corporation, and there's another corporation,
right,
too, a Conestoga Paper Products, I think.
So to force his corporation, which he owns, to provide contraception against his religious his religion is a violation of his religious freedom.
They're not forcing him to do anything.
Under the Affordable Care Act, he is forced to either provide the contraception or pay the tax, so-called. Is he not?
Right. Yes. So he has a choice.
He has a choice to pay a penalty or to do what he believes is religiously correct.
Yes.
So could you say that there are two different kind of rights being at stake here, whether David Green's or his employees' so-called rights?
Well, it's a corporation's right. He is the stockholder. See, he's trying to have his cake and eat it too. He's trying to say, I want the tax advantages of being a corporation. I want to be able to deduct my 3 martini lunches and have my corporate jet or whatever, you know, kind of luxuries David may have. And he's got 14,000 employees, so I'm guessing he has some substantial luxuries. And deduct those things, have you know, my workers pay the taxes on those rather than me. I want to have those advantages. I want to have limitations of liability. And I want to assert that this corporate form that I'm using to get all these goodies and benefits, this corporate form also has the ability to assert to reflect my religious preferences.
Well, I disagree. It's not
in violation of the law.
How it's using it.
I beg your pardon?
He's providing a good and a service, and he's employing hundreds of thousands of people.
No, 14,000 people.
No, it's more than that.
Okay, whatever. Maybe I thought it was 14,000 employees. I may well be wrong, but that's not germane to the. Let's say it's 140,000. It's not germane to the point.
Right.
The point is that he is making use of the corporate form, and he is asserting that he has this religious right that is being violated. There were people in the 50s, and even the early 1960s, who were asserting that their religion made it impossible for them to serve black people in their restaurants or in their hotels. And in fact, this was the official position of the Mormon Church. The Marriott family is very Mormon. I don't know if they did this in their hotels or not, but they, you know, you always get the Book of Mormon when you check into a Marriott hotel and the bedstand next to you. People were asserting their religious right to discriminate against people based on race. The courts struck that down. How is that different?
Because that's discriminating on somebody's race. See, they're not being required to positively provide something that is against their religion, as they are in this case. I mean, that's a totally different issue than not serving somebody because they're black or of a different race, is it not?
Well, it may be. It may be that you have a point.
Okay. Well, Tom, we've loved being on your show. We'll certainly call back. Thank you. We really enjoy it.
Okay. Thank you, the Jordans. Let me ponder that one. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Parry.
Hi, Tom. Well, I'm the guy who talked about the large-scale structure of the universe.
Aha!
And it's like brain neurons.
You're the one who got me started on this thing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The thing is, I just saw that, you know, and I come from kind of an artist background, and I just thought these visually, you know, it just the overlap was incredible,
yeah,
especially as they rotate around it. It's a NASA production. But, you know, maybe dark matter is brain matter, and maybe we're living inside of a universal brain. I didn't say it was God or anything like that. It's just, you know, it's a whole bunch of possibilities.
And I'm not asserting it either. In my mind the jury's out. Although I do, you know, science tells me that fractals are real, and it may well be that the dark matter, the Higgs boson, that the Higgs field in the universe is the same thing as what's the fluid in our brain? It's synovial fluid, is that? No, that's in joints.
Quite sure.
Yeah, whatever the name of that fluid is that you know that's in the brain and the brainstem, or blood for that matter. I mean, you know, it might be the stuff that's just holding it all together, or in which it is all suspended. And the neurons in our brain are the functional equivalent of the interaction of gravitational fields between bodies. But, you know, it just makes a certain amount of sense to me. Anyhow, Harvey, thanks a lot for the call. Always great to hear from you. We have to wrap up this hour. In the next hour, Amber Barno is going to be with us, a conservative writer and commentator, regular guest on Fox News. We're going to talk about this judge who told women lawyers not to dress provocatively in his courtroom.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Very interesting. This federal judge has a blog. It's called Hercules and the Empire and the Role of the Federal Trial Judge. And on his blog on March 25th, 2 days ago, he posted this article. It's titled On Being a Dirty Old Man and How Young Women Lawyers Dress. And it has provoked, you know, basically a firestorm of commentary. He's reacting to a piece that Amanda Hess wrote titled Female Lawyers Who Dress Too Sexy Are Apparently a Huge Problem in the Courtroom. This was on Slate on March 21st. And he talks about in a recent case. In fact, I'm reading from his blog. In a recent case involving this fine young lawyer, every female law, he's talking about a young woman who was she writes well, she's brilliant, she speaks well, blah-de-blah-de-blah, but she wears short skirts and shows lots of her ample chest. And he says, I really appreciate the last two attributes. He's exaggerating or stating his role as a dirty old man, I guess. But then he gets to the end. He says, you can't win. Men are both pigs and prudes. Get over it. Number two, it's not about you. That goes double when you're appearing in front of a jury. And number three, think about the female law clerks. If they are likely to label you like Jane Curtin and ignorant, S-word behind your back, tone it down. It seems to me that there's a larger issue here, and that is that we're not having a conversation about men wearing cod pieces into the courtroom or you know, getting pumped up on steroids and then showing up in court in a T-shirt to flex their biceps. What kind of societal expectations that women grow up with and are facing every single day in not just the world but the workplace are producing the behavior that's producing the backlash that's not this, neither of which are happening to men. Amber Barno is with us, a conservative writer and commentator, regular guest over at Fox News, her website, Amber Barno, BARNO.com. And Amber, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what are your thoughts on this judge and this comment?
Well, first of all, I think that this judge can say whatever he wants to, just the same way this female lawyer can wear whatever she wants to. you're responsible for your own actions, for your own words, and the consequences that go along with them. She may or may not have experienced some sort of negative responses from the way that she dressed, but I personally think that this is strictly a professional issue. Some people may consider it unprofessional for a federal judge to blog about being a dirty old man and calling some of his colleagues ignorant sluts.
Right. There are a lot of people asserting that. To put the shoe on the other foot, to mangle a metaphor, if a man were to show up as an attorney in a courtroom, wearing short shorts, wearing Lieutenant Dangle shorts, wouldn't that provoke a response? And isn't an issue worthy of discussion here that never happens, that men don't do that? And why is it that there are some women who feel the pressure or the need to do something similar to that, and men don't feel that pressure?
Well, I think, yes, if a man showed up to represent his clients in court in flip-flops and shorts, just as I mentioned, he would be viewed as completely unprofessional, and it might affect him with future jobs.
We can agree on that point, and frankly, I suspect that we're agreeing on most of this stuff. But I'm just wondering why a woman, if a man would not basically assert his sexuality in court, his good looks, why would a woman feel the need to, on the one hand, and on the, apparently this has reached the point where you've got a federal judge saying, hey, dial it back, you're hurting yourself. What has happened in our...
on the person, what they grew up with, what was acceptable. Just like the judge said in his blog, his daughter walked down the stairs one time when they were going out, and he was shocked and was like, go put on some clothes or a sweater or whatever to cover yourself up.
It's because they were going to a Catholic church.
This lady didn't have that, and she grew up thinking that, certain clothing is acceptable when it's not. I don't think that it's strictly, all females are like this and think that it's okay to flaunt their sexuality more than men. I think it just depends on the person.
Well, I don't disagree. I'm trying to figure out if there's an issue here beyond a judge being... actually thinking that he's offering good advice. Let me share some wisdom and from my experience to, a female attorney, and maybe it is even good advice. In fact, it appears it probably is very good advice. But he's doing it in a way that's has been certified as politically incorrect by the people who certify political correctness. So in that regard, it's kind of a tempest in a teapot. But the bigger picture issue that it raises for me is why is it necessary, what is the societal issue that's provoking this as a question? And I realize that there are people like Pat Buchanan who would say, I don't want to put words in Pat's mouth, but I Pat and I have talked enough times over the years, But let's say of the old school male conservative persuasion, who would say this is because women were allowed in the workplace and they never should have been there in the first place, and that kind of thing. I mean, which is not what this judge was saying, that's how extreme I think some of the response to this is going to get.
Yeah, I think you're right. I agree with you. I think a lot of what this judge wrote and blogged about is going to be taken a bit out of context and sort of skewed in a way that makes it look like, he's against women in the courtroom or whatever, which I actually, the way I read it, he was sort of concerned for his colleague who was dressing inappropriately, and he basically thought that it was going to have negative repercussions for her career, whether it just be the people that she works with. Or
no, that's how I read it too.
Seriously, but if he was giving her advice, and yeah, I think some people need to get some thicker skin.
Yeah, that's how I read it too, and maybe I'm looking for an issue that isn't here, but it just, you know, we have a little less than a minute, Amber. Do you think that women feel a pressure to be sexualized in the workplace that men don't feel?
I don't think so. I think that appearances matter, especially when it comes to the workplace. It's all about what's appropriate. When I go to the beach, I wear a bathing suit. When I go to work and I want to be taken seriously as a professional and expert in my field, I dress accordingly.
Right, but you don't think that there are some women who feel that they need to dress in a way that's sexy?
No, I don't.
Then why do they do it?
Well, I don't think it's a whole. Like, I don't think women in general dress.
So you think they're just outliers, that the exception that proves the rule?
Yeah, absolutely. There are some women that do and some women that don't. Some care about their appearance. Some don't.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just wondering why it's not happening with men. Anyhow, Amber Berno, it's nice talking with you today. Thanks for dropping by.
It was great talking with you, too. Thanks so much.
You can read Amber's writings over at AmberBarno, AmberBarno.com. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So now have I gone totally politically incorrect? I don't know. I think it's an interesting issue, though. I mean, this is the kind of thing, I read the original story, and it was like this judge is saying, don't dress like an ignorant slut, to paraphrase the phrase from Jane Curtin's famous Saturday Night Live skit. And originally I thought,
Jane, you ignorant slut.
Yeah, there you go. It's right out of Saturday Night Live. So, you know, when I first read this, I thought, oh, my goodness, this judge is like, you know, just totally out of line. And then I went over and I read his blog, and I thought, you know, he's probably being a little more honest than he should. He's revealing more about himself than most people would do about his own, you know, experience, his own past, and his own worldview. But I think it reflects that of a guy who's probably in his 60s or older, you know, just the generation that he grew up in. But this larger issue of, you know, why are, well, anyway, I'm trying to make more out of this than is there. Chris, watching Free Speech TV on Roku, which is just a total hoot. Louise and I have a Roku box. We love it. And we have the Free Speech TV channel on it, too, in Napa, California. You want to get back to atheism, right?
Chris? Oh, hello?
Yeah. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to say that I thought that atheism is really a political movement. It has nothing to do with the religious movements.
How so?
Well, it's a backlash, I think, against it's a continuation of enlightenment and a backlash against Bronze Age thinking.
So you're positing that atheism is completely reactive. What would be a non-reactive? What would be a proactive form of skepticism? How would what kind of atheist would not be reactive?
Well, I would call an agnostic a fence-sitter.
So I wouldn't disagree with that. But so you're saying that an agnostic would be a non-reactive person, but that an atheist is a reactive person. That's an interesting analysis. Chris, thank you for the call. Not sure exactly how to respond to it. Let me ponder it for a minute. Fred, in Niceville, Florida. Fred, you had an out-of-body experience? Fred? No Fred. Okay. Here's how it works, my friends. First of all, we've got a 7 or 9 second delay right here in the studio. that happens to everybody on radio and whatnot. So if somebody says a dirty word, we can push the button. And then on top of that, there's the delay that involves our signal going from our studio here all the way to Denver, where it gets chewed up and processed by the Free Speech TV computers and whatnot. And then they send it to another company that in Colorado, it's always happens in Colorado because it's the highest point in North America, right? And then they send it to another company just down the road who bumps it up to the satellites in the sky to Dish Network and DirecTV. And if you're watching on a cable system, they get it off one of those two satellites. And if you're watching on Dish or Direct, it's coming from that satellite down to your TV. And that whole route from right here all the way to Denver, up to outer space and back down to you, takes some time, actually, 10, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, something like that. So there's a slight delay. So when you're on hold, you have to be sure to listen to your phone, not your TV. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. And boy, we've got an eclectic collection of callers and topics. And it's not Anything Goes Friday, but I'm fine with all this. Danielle says that Sean says that apparently Fred left his body before I picked up the phone. Oh my! Thank you, Sean. Gary in Chicago. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Well, with so much complexity to the design of the body, and plus we have self-awareness, we make plans, we make decisions. I don't know how we can attribute creation to a random haphazard chance coincidence when an intelligent designer must be there because of so much complexity.
What if the complexity is simply the natural result of some very, very fundamental laws and forces playing out and being acted upon?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Intelligent designer. To have those kind of things you just said, we have to have not a random haphazard chance, but we have to have intelligence, designing and, setting these things in motion.
So what was there that produced the intelligent designer? Where did the intelligent designer come from?
Well, the intelligent designer, it's...
Who designed the intelligent designer?
Well, it would be too complex for us to discern, simply because, there's so much, intelligence and there's so much, complexity in all design. The molecule and how it acts and things like that, that just can't move around randomly.
No, but it can be described mathematically. It can be described with fairly simple physics and science and math and all the natural things that come out of it. I mean, even now they're discovering even like water, for example, that stars blow off. Stars are giant fusion reactors, and so you've got a lot of hydrogen blowing off stars, and it's blowing off these stars in ways that are they're ionized, that have they carry an electrical charge. And that when they hit the upper atmosphere, they bind to oxygen and they form water. So there's like this continuous rain of water as the consequence of simply being a planet in the path of a star. And that there are, organic forms that come about as a consequence. I mean, the entire thing could be described by natural law. And I think that where you and I might be making separate arguments is you're asserting that something very much like us, some thinking, intelligent being hatched the idea of the natural law that produced the universe. And what I'm saying is maybe the universe is what is producing the intelligent being. In this case, the one that we know of is us, but maybe there's something more. Am I making any sense at all here, Gary?
Well, I just don't understand complexity as a random chance coincidence.
It Why
would
not?
Seem like the laws of nature were set in motion by something that was intelligent beyond ourselves.
No, I get your assertion of that. But then the question, who designed the designer? If you're going to say that the universe is too complex for just some simple forces acting upon each other in ways that, and a lot of random stuff going on, to produce the kind of complexity that is you and me and the world around us. If you're going to assert that there therefore had to be an intelligent designer, then you're also asserting that something designed the designer, right? Because that would be the same level. That would be an even greater level of complexity, presumably.
Well, right. We'll take it back to when there was nothing. So if there was nothing, you know, the abhorrence of the fact that there would be totally nothing and nothing in existence, then that, you know, abhorring thought that nothing would come into existence would be the, you know, motivation factor that would bring something into existence.
Okay. This is one of the cosmological arguments. You know, there's this theory that universes are actually like little bubbles and they're constantly being formed and constantly vanishing, and our universe is one of many. You know, the foam theory, which actually has some fairly high level adherence. I'm wondering if that's possible, if our entire universe is a fractal within a larger universe, if these bubbles are functionally, you know, if you could look at them in the large scale structures of the universe, you'd see that they look like a neural network too. And, you know, within the universe, you've got galaxies, and within the galaxies, you've got solar systems, and then you get down to us, and that the whole thing is insanely complex, but it's all complex because it all operates under some very, very simple natural laws. But where did it all start?
Well, I think the abhorrence, you know, the horrific thought that nothing would exist was catalyst for something to come into existence.
And right. Well, this is kind of a variation on the original Big Bang theory, that in the beginning there was black nothingness, or the entire universe was filled. It was solid. It was all filled with the simplest form of energy that there is, the Higgs field or something, and it twitched. There was just a slight perturbation in that, and that then started invoking these natural forces that caused masses of it to explode from a singularity, from a tiny point. You know, there are others who suggest that that point is actually the backside of the equivalent of a black hole that some other universe is bleeding through and coming into. I mean, these are the nobody knows kinds of things which make, in my mind, glib assurances that either it's a Bronze Age God or there is no God or there is nothing there. Glib. Anyhow, Gary, thank you for the call. I don't have any answers. I'm just blown away by the whole thing. I find all of it awesome.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm in awe of the whole thing. And I think, well, you know, one of the most powerful religious experiences that I personally can provide to myself is to look up the sky at night. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk Media for the rest of us. And Marge in Torrance, California, you were the first woman to wear a miniskirt before the Supreme Court?
Yeah, and Tom, I did something more you ought to know. First of all, I was first woman bank lawyer in 1961. And it cost the bank a lot of money when the Justice Department represented me in an EEOC action that went to the United States Supreme Court twice. I also then became area director for Neighborhood Legal Services. And I've never taken judges more seriously than anybody else. As someone once said, you know, we all put on, I think Nader is saying now, you know, we can get rid of those 532 guys. They all put on their shoes just like we do. But the thing is that during 1954, there was a dress code, and the Supreme Court sentenced a woman to major sanctions for wearing short sleeves and a knit suit. So when I became active at Neighborhood Legal Services, and especially in community activities, I came into court. I first went up to the United States Supreme Court, and before the Warren Court, I wore a miniskirt. But we had to ask permission, and it turned into a really fun and games thing. My parents had the joy of watching me stand up while Chief Justice Warren says to me, "Ms. Buckley, it's really a pleasure to welcome you to this court." But then I appeared to argue before the United States Supreme Court, and as Judge Blackman put it, when I had to go and ask if it was all right to wear a pantsuit, he said to me, "We don't really care as long as you are neat and clean, but Chief Justice Berger isn't going to like it." Hmm. So I wore my pantsuit anyway because the clerks told me that that Berger would never dissent unless he could get somebody else to do it with him.
Wow.
But it was really, you know, and by the way, I won 9-0 the right for poor people in this country to be candidates, for all the poor people in this country to be candidates for political office without paying fees. The problem is that with United Citizens, that is, it just, you know, there went my glory out the window, and there go the rights of poor people out the window.
With Citizens United decision, yeah, I'm with you. I was reading this legal blog this morning, and it said that, and now I think I've lost the page. Oh, here it is. Before the United States Supreme Court, until the 1970s, they required attorneys to wear what's called morning dress, and for men, this is striped trousers, a gray ascot, a waistcoat, and a cutaway morning coat. This is stuff that you see in movies from the 19th century. Is that how the Solicitor General was dressed? And apparently Elena Kagan, when she became the Solicitor General, showed up in a pantsuit and just kind of blew everything up.
Well, in 1973, when I argued before the United States Supreme Court, which is, by the way, a powerful experience, but the problem, you see, I think with the miniskirt issue was that here you had 9 old men in dresses, and here came a ballsy female lawyer who challenged him.
Right. Right.
And probably made them wonder what the hell was going on. But no, they, in 73, when they wrote the article up about someone appearing in a pantsuit, they didn't bother to talk to me. But what they did do was they said that the attorneys appearing on behalf of the government had to wear these uniform kinds of things. And what they did with the women was, while the men wore pants and then the long tails, women wore striped skirts and then the long tails.
Wow.
And, you know, it's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the thing is that when I was before the California Municipal Court, and I proposed to, and I came in a pantsuit, the judge offered to throw me in jail if I didn't go home and put on my clothes. I was area director for Neighborhood Legal Services at that point. We were well organized. So my community, we immediately went out. I got 10 lawyers to come and represent me, and we had group of people immediately called City News. City News called the attorney and said, the judge, and said, "Are you really going to send her to jail?" At which point he called the presiding judge. And the presiding judge said, "What'd you say her name was?" And he said, "Oh, Buckley or something." He says, "Get rid of her. Get rid of her. You'll be on TV tonight. You'll look like a silly ass. Get rid of her."
Huh.
And he tried, but I would not go until he acknowledged the fact that I refused to take my pantsuit off. After that, for a long time, I never wore anything except pantsuits.
That's a remarkable story, Marge. But why do you think it is that women have gone through this and men have basically not? And that men haven't felt the need to buck that. I mean, you don't see men wanting to show up before the Supreme Court, you know, without a tie on, for example, or you know, without a sports coat.
It's because they have the rank, they have the privilege, and therefore it doesn't bother them to have to wear the fancy clothes, which cost them a lot of money. But I'll tell you, during the 60s and 70s, it was in the 70s that I was area director. I mean, I wore my uniform when I was at the uniform, when I was at the bank for 5 years. I mean, it was partly because it was a business thing, and it wasn't until I got bored and was willing to challenge both their refusal to give me a title. I mean, they kept giving me pay raises, but they wouldn't give me a title. Right. And I think it has to do with male attitudes. I mean, I think the problem is that in our patriarchy, the fact that you are a male brings certain privilege to you.
Yes.
And during the 60s and 70s, some of the men did go around. I saw one activist attorney who used to appear with a beard and in cowboy boots and a cowboy hat. And it was a challenge, but most of the attorneys didn't feel that way. They were having their fun in their Brooks Brothers, you know, suits.
Right.
They could afford all of that, and unless you were an attorney for poor people, you really...
That's right. Lee, what was the guy's name? Lee, his first name was Lee, who was a famous lawyer. He used to wear cowboy boots and...
Oh, you know, I'm sorry. This is 2014, right?
Yeah.
And I.
Yeah, that was back in the 70s and 80s. You know, back in the in 99, I think it was, or 2000, I got an invitation to a private audience with Pope John Paul II, and so I replied asking if my wife could come with me, and they said yes, she could, and then they proceeded to send a 14-page fax about how she should dress. There had been nothing about how I should dress, but you know, all this detail about what she had to wear, what had to be covered, what couldn't be covered. And they said that the Pope would not, she should not extend her hand to the Pope, she should not speak to the Pope if she was beside me. When we finally got up to meet the Pope, he turned to Louise, reached out, shook her hand, and engaged in conversation with her. You know, she was a nice guy, you know, but it's like they're I mean, it was like double standard on display. And so you're if I'm understanding you correctly, Marge, what you're saying is that women who are dressing in ways that are unconventional in the courtroom are not doing it. They're not trying to sexualize anything. They're simply trying to assert in some way their prerogative and power in defiance of male authority and power, which is traditional and ingrained.
Yeah. I think I'm saying a lot of that, right? I think it's also a blow at this idea that we all need to be uniformed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, of course.
Effley Bailey was the guy I was thinking of.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yes, pardon me.
But I have to say that I had a reputation for raising issues and those which I thought were kind of important, and actually managed to do some work that did change some of the law. In fact, I was counted just recently as one of the women who, in the last century, because I was very active in the civil rights movement, I was at Wounded Knee, I was at Mississippi doing some work with the Freedom Houses on my first vacation as a bank lawyer. And the first thing that happened when I got back was I had lunch with some of the officers whom I served. I was their generalist. And they said, "Did you have a good vacation?" I said, "Yeah." And they said, "What'd you do?" I said, "Oh, I went down to Mississippi." And that was when Viola Lusa was killed, by the way. I was down there then. And I said, "Oh, it's, you know, working in the Freedom Houses." And he said, "Oh, you're such a kidder." And I said, "I'm not kidding." So he says, "Well, can we go and have a beer tonight? And you can tell us about it." And I said, "Well, I'm sorry." I said, "But I have to go over to the jail." And that's where I met, I have to go over to the jail because the Watts riots had happened and I needed to help people get out of jail.
Wow. Marge, it's an honor talking with you. I'm sorry that the automation equipment here has fired the brake. I have no control over it. But thank you so much for sharing your stories with us. It's great to hear from you.
I've been listening to you back when you were on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Thank you, Marge, for listening to us for so long. I appreciate it. Thank you for your kind words. I'm telling you, we have just sitting in the seat is sometimes so humbling because some of the most extraordinary people call into this program, and I am so pleased and honored to be able to share, you know, 5 days a week with y'all. And it's one of the reasons why I so rarely go on vacation. Gary in Mount Hermon, Louisiana. Hey, Gary, you wanted to get back to Hobby Lobby?
Well, yes, sir. And first of all, I wanted to say a little bit about what you're talking about a living wage for people that are homeless and poor and all. And also, you know, we need this single-payer medical thing for everybody.
Yeah.
This is America, you know. We should have some compassion for our fellow citizens. But anyway, yeah, the Hobby Lobby thing, I don't see how this dude can force his views, his beliefs on other people. Isn't that kind of like the Jim Crow type stuff, you know? I mean, what's next? He's not going to hire Jews, or, you know, or what? What's the?
Well, that's the concern, is that if the Supreme Court goes along with this and says that the Green family can use a corporation as a shield against liability, they can use a corporation to gain tremendous tax advantages for themselves, and they can use the corporation to pass through their religious perspectives, is, you know, what's next? Is what about an organization? What about a business? You know, what happens when the Klan goes out and buys a McDonald's franchise? What happens if the Jehovah's Witnesses buy a McDonald's franchise or whatever, and they say, you know, our insurance doesn't cover blood transfusions, or Christian Scientists, you know, our insurance doesn't cover anything except prayer, and it's like, where does this end? That slippery slope argument, and I think you're right, Gary. Gary, thanks a lot for the call. Tor in Johnson Valley, California, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Tor, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
Hey, I plan on being in Salt Lake for Easter.
Oh, great. You're going to go to the Atheist Convention. I hope you have a wonderful time.
I hope I do, too. The problem you're having, and some of your callers, is with the word belief. Mm. I have no belief systems. I believe in nothing. Matter of fact, I have a hard time with the...
Well, wait a minute. You just asserted a belief. You said you believe in nothing. That's a positive assertion of belief.
Well, if you want to extend it out that way. But atheists don't believe there is no God. We deny the existence of a God.
But isn't denial an assertion of belief?
Oh, well, I guess you can say any word is a belief then.
Well, I think most things are, actually. I think that there's, in my world, I mean, I'm with Schrodinger. There's not a lot of certainty.
But... And shame on you for saying atheists should run the same scam as churches. I know it was
it's a good scam.
But, huh?
It's a good scam.
Yeah, right.
I think that if atheists ran that scam, it would wake people up to what a scam it is, and we would start saying, and in fact, this is why I was so pleased when we had him on the program a couple of weeks ago, or maybe it was a few months ago, these Satan worshipers who wanted to have, you know, their satanic things on the lawn of the Mississippi State House or whatever it was. Tor, thanks for the call. It's the True People's Media, the Tom and Hartman Program, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Jonah in Denver, listening on AM 760. You want to talk about sociopaths and neuroplasticity?
Oh, I didn't hear the name part. I think I am a soft touch for being upset, because I have Tourette's.
Okay.
And I just get worried about stringing, not being able to tell if the notion of born that way is going to have exceptions, because not everybody wants to make an exception when they understand what I do is behavior. and know what they mean by that.
Right.
Because if anything indicates that we can't just scan the brain and figure out what's going on, my condition is it. And then when I'm honest about that, the logical debate goes to, is this something else that's still at play?
Right.
And does it, what difference does it make if you're going to say that's a condition, too, and two, you've never cured it, and you when dealing with doctors, and you take a little bit of credit for, based on a scale, information that doesn't allow for how wrong you've been. I got worse when I was 28. Mm-hmm. I have to be afraid to say that. It's supposed to get worse most of the time when you're a kid, and I got to face the revamp.
Yeah. I mean, so Jonah,
obvious, and you could see it from three blocks away. Well, then what else will it align with? It's like, I don't know, and neither do you. It's not something they like to hear.
Correct. And uncertainty makes everybody nervous, it seems, which I think is one of the voids that religion fills in. Jonah, thank you for calling and sharing your story with us. Good to hear from you. Thomas in Horseheads, New York. Hey, Thomas, you want to talk about the guy who was raising the dead yesterday?
Yes. I have a kind of an emotional reaction to that. I just wanted to make three quick points, going from a broad spiritual kind of a perspective, narrowing down into Christian kind of fundamental beliefs.
Right.
The first point is people don't ever die, for one thing.
Okay.
Okay. And two, people are much happier after they die where they are.
Okay.
Two. And three, claiming that you resurrect someone from the dead with the help or in the name of Jesus is considered to people, Christians who take their religion seriously, that is blasphemy.
Well, a number of questions occurred to me after I got off the phone with the guy. I shared some of them on the air. Another one of the questions that occurred to me that I didn't say out loud was if somebody has died and gone to a really good place and you're sucking them back to this world of woes, aren't you doing them a disservice rather than a service? You may be doing their loved ones a service by bringing them back. But see, I frankly believe the guy's running a scam, and he's hustling money from people, and he's doing these seminars, and I just think it's a scam. But it does raise some interesting philosophical and epistemological questions. Thomas, thanks for sharing. Thanks for your thoughts. And good to hear from you. Kathleen in Hoffman Estates, Illinois. Hey, Kathleen, what's up? You wanted to get back to Hobby Lobby?
Yes, Tom. I was responding to the Jordans when they made the point that, he's doing is making a wonderful pitch for his own religious belief, and you didn't really have an answer of what he was taking away, like the lunch counter rights when people sat,
right.
Were denied before. What he's trying to do is not deny his customers, he's denying his employees, and specifically his women employees, from the full benefit, the benefits under the law now that we all as a nation agree, even though everybody doesn't believe that,
right.
Majority rules. And so he's denying them, his female employees, a benefit of insurance
right.
coverage.
Yeah, no, I make that assertion, but that's a right at law as opposed to a constitutional right. The lunch counter thing was framed in the context of the 14th Amendment. I think, frankly, that we might want to seriously think about amending the Constitution as Franklin Roosevelt suggested in 1940. Where he came out with his new Bill of Rights, and he said we need to amend the Constitution to say that we all persons in America have a right to health care, have a right to a remunerative job, was his phrase, and have a right to housing, that these are our fundamental rights. But the right to health care is not a fundamental right in the United States as of the moment. There is a law, but it's not a right. And that was what was going through my mind when I didn't respond to Jordan with some glib response. Am I making sense?
I just think, yes, but I just think this whole argument is really just an effort to use whatever means necessary, if religion is the hammer you want to use, to knock down any kind of medical any type of the Obamacare continuing on.
I agree, and in fact, I'll take it beyond that. I think that this is an effort to discredit the Obama presidency. This is his signature achievement. This is going to be the thing that goes down in history as what President Obama did. And, you know, Reagan did tax cuts and according to the mythology, ended the Soviet Union, although the Soviet Union actually collapsed during George W. Herbert Walker Bush's presidency. But, you know, and Kennedy had the Cuban Missile Crisis and got assassinated. And that's what he's famous for. And, you know, Obama is going to be famous for Obamacare. And so they're trying to tear this down. They're trying to destroy the legacy of an accomplishment of a Democratic president. I think that that's all about that. It's all about, you know, a Democrat did something right, something that was a Republican idea. You know, it was hatched by the Heritage Foundation. It was put into place in Massachusetts by Mitt Romney. A Democrat tried to do it, and therefore we cannot allow that to stand. And I think that it's totally political. Kathleen, thank you for the call, and thanks for your comments. This has been the strategy of the Republicans from day one. Literally, from the conspiracy over here at the caucus room restaurant the night that Obama was first sworn in, to Mitch McConnell saying, this is my number one job, is to destroy his presidency. Coming up tomorrow, it's Friday. That means Brunch with Bernie. America's senator will be here taking your calls, our national town hall meeting, plus anything goes Friday. And remember, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. So get out there and get active and occupy something. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.